Terry spoke to the Beastie Boys in 2006 when they released a concert film called Awesome, I Shot That. Adam Yauch directed the film using footage from cameras that were distributed to fans in the audience of one of their New York concerts.
Now, the movie was shot in Madison Square Garden. The first time you performed there, you opened for Madonna. Now, I understand on that tour, her fans booed you just about in every performance.
Oh, they did a lot more than that.
What did they do?
Some audience members were crying, actually. Yeah, it was touching, but actually
I remember getting
upsetting.
Yelled at by a parent because we were cursing, and they were like, how could you do that when I'm here with my
child,
young child?
What was it like relatively early in your career to be booed so frequently on somebody else's tour?
We got up for it, really.
You get kind of like into pro wrestler mode where you kind of get into it for a while. It's kind of funny.
Come on! That's where the whole King of the Paramount came
from.
Yeah,
we got into a mode for a while where we'd come out and they wouldn't boo, and then we'd try and do things to get them to boo. Like they would be applauding, and we'd just say, you know, it's really hard to get up here, and you should...
We need to be appreciated by you people.
What's it like now to sing things that you wrote, 20, 25 years ago, when you were much younger? You've changed a lot over the years. Do the lyrics still fit you?
It's a little awkward at times. It's a bit awkward.
Some of them are dumb, but yeah, it's just fun. You know, sometimes it's fun to just play the old songs anyway, no matter how stupid they are.
Have you revised any lyrics that you're no longer comfortable with? Lyrics from
yeah, we. I mean, I know I do personally. Some of the stuff that I say on License to Ill, I say some real dumb stuff, and so. You know, I like the song, and the song's important to, people that like us or listen to us, and so it's important. So, if that's what people want, we should, why not play the songs? But there's some things that I don't like to say.
Can you give us an example of something you've changed?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but just some dumb things about, I don't even know.
It's usually the more sexist ones are the ones you switch up.
I do have one that I'm particularly proud of, and I'm not sure even who it came from, but in No Sleep to Brooklyn, I say, and Yauch's in the back at the Mahjong board.
Yeah,
and I'm not even sure what is the original.
I don't even know if we could say it on the air.
Yeah, I don't even know what. Yeah, if we could, but I just particularly like that because it kind of really reflects where we're at now.
Your first hit was "Fight for Your Right," and Adam Yauch, in the liner notes of a Best Of collection, you write that the song began as a goof and that it started as a satire of "I Want to Rock" kind of songs. So, what did you have in mind when you wrote that?
Yeah, basically that. I think you summed it up. It was just kind of like just one of those like smoking in the boys' room type things. Just thought it was kind of funny, but I don't think we realized that it was going to be the main focus of the album. That it was going to, like, I think the way we were looking at it, we were just kind of making this dumb song that had sit somewhere on the album. But I think that CBS and Rick and saw it as being able to be something much larger than what we imagined, and they kind of made it the main focus of the album.
Let me play the record, and then we'll talk about it a little bit more.
Okay.
Fantastic.
And this is the Beastie Boys, "Fight for Your Right."
Kick it!
Okay, so this is like your first big single, a really big hit, and you're saying it started out kind of as a goof. So did your fans misunderstand who you were?
I think maybe we just ended up with a different bunch of fans than we expected. Like, I think if we could have picked at the time, like if I could have known like how much that record would have, that song would have informed everyone about the album, to use Mike's word, informed. My choice would have been more to pick like a different song to be the main single, like Hold It Now or Slow and Low or Posse in Effect or one of the other cuts. But anyway, that song was the one that informed everyone. And so next thing you knew, we would go out and play shows and look, and the whole place would just be full of like frat boys, like drunken frat boys. And so it was, so there we were.
You know, we were talking earlier about going from punk to hip hop. So I don't imagine you had a big, you know, frat boy audience for your band when you were playing punk.
We definitely didn't when we were punk, and then also when we were playing hip hop, like what we came out of by hooking up with Russell, we got like a really good education in terms of going on tour and opening up for Run DMC. Like we were on a tour opening for Run DMC, Houdini, mm-hmm. LL Cool J. So that was like a completely hip hop audience. So to then all of a sudden go into this world of like kind of like, I don't know, I guess a more pop audience and like kind of college kids wanting to party and drink beer and go see a Beastie Boys show, that was completely foreign to us and beyond anything we ever imagined.
Adam, in those liner notes you write, by drinking so much beer and acting like sexist macho jerks, we actually became just that. So did you feel like...
I never said that.
did you feel like you were becoming the image that you created?
I think so, yeah. I think in a way, you know, it's almost like we started out kind of like goofing on it, but then just sort of became it in a way.
It's the become what you hate syndrome. Yeah. So you
set out with an agenda of parody, and then a certain amount of time goes by and you kind of cross that line.
Yeah, like you parody something enough. You know?
It's kind of like when you go to England and you do a British accent the whole time and then you come home and you have a fake British accent.
So was there a point where
you know what I mean?
Yeah, was there a point where no? was there a point where you said to yourselves, "We crossed the line. We've become our own parody."
Definitely, but I don't. I think that point almost came like we had to kind of get off of tour, and almost have a second away from that to sort of assess and realize look where everything was at.
And so, what changed when you had that realization?
We switched to weed.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And then we made Paul's Boutique,
which was very different from which I think some fans loved and some fans felt disappointed because it was a departure. What was different about it?
Well, weed is a good word. It weeded out. It weeded out some fans too, and that was okay.
And found some fans that were weeded out.
Yeah, and the fans that got that moved on to U2 or Skritti Politti or I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think like with Paul's Boutique, you had two things going on. You had like people who probably expected like Fight for Your Right to Party Part 2 and they were very disappointed and were like, this isn't what I want at all.
And they got weeded out.
And they got weeded out. And then there were the fans that were like, wow, this is whatever. This is something I'm really into. And they got weeded out too.
They got weeded out.
They got in a different meaning of the word.
You each come from families with pretty interesting artistic backgrounds. So if we could go around and if you could each talk a little bit about how, if at all, your parents' kind of artistic inclinations affected you when you were coming of age and developing your own artistic sensibility. Adam Horovitz, let's start with you. I mean, your father's a pretty well-known playwright, Israel Horovitz.
Yeah. I grew up, my dad, every time I was with my dad, he was always, not always, but he wrote. He's a writer, so he was always in his office writing. He made a plan, like a point of, this is my work. I'm going to do this every day for these amount of hours. So I think that's where I got like a work sort of ethic. That's why we work so many hours we spend in the studio, and it just seemed kind of natural because just watching my dad, how many hours he just spends in his office just writing and writing. Even when he doesn't have any particular story he's writing, you know what I mean? He'll just go in and just, these are the hours he's got to do it. So... you know, it was definitely influential to me just in terms of like a work ethic, just create whatever, you know, whatever you do, create something. And that was kind of the impression I got. And definitely from my mom was a very, very artistic person. And that's I got creativity from my mother.
Michael Diamond, your parents were in interior design. Do I have that right?
Well, my dad was actually involved with the art world. He was an art dealer.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know. For me, I'd just say my influences, I had two things. One was I was the biggest thing for me, I was the youngest of three brothers. Mm-hmm. So growing up here in Manhattan in New York City at the time that we grew up, like in the 70s and the 80s, it was such an influential time of so much music happening, so much, you know, just kind of like everywhere. And it's, you know, this is a time before the internet, you know, you really had to have local access to things. And things, and it was just like you had hip hop, you had reggae, you had punk rock. I don't know how I, what my entrance to all this kind of music would have been if I wasn't the youngest of three kids, because it was kind of like whatever my oldest brothers were going through, I wanted to do the same thing at the same time. So even though I was like 12 or 13, whatever they were doing when they were 16, I had to be involved with it.
So what were they listening to that you loved?
I mean, whatever, that transition. I mean, that went from, like, stealing my brother's, you know, Steve Miller, Fly Like an Eagle album to then, like, discovering Elvis Costello through him to then, you know, getting turned on to hip-hop from my friends or stealing, you know, one of my brother's Bob Marley records. Yeah, I don't know. And then for my parents, I'm trying to think. I think, like, the biggest influence I got from my parents was just being exposed all the time to, like, they were really good about, especially since we grew up here in Manhattan, it wasn't like they would go to events and we'd stay at home. It's like all the time we'd be going to art-type
galas?
Functions. We'd be going to gala. No, I don't know. Gala events. I think the kids got left at home for gala events.
Right. I'd leave the kids at home for
but,
gala.
But, you know, if you're going to, like, an opening or, you know, all the time, there were, like, you'd have, like, whatever, creative people kind of coming in and out. And I think, like, I learned as much from the kind of creative people around the periphery of, like, my parents as I did from going to school in a lot of ways.
Adam Yauch, your father's an architect. Do I have that right?
Yeah, but he's actually more of a painter. He went to art school for painting for a long time, and then he switched over to architecture, and he did that for a while, and now he's gone back to painting, and I think he's...
Google him.
What influence has that had on you?
Well, you know, I went to college for a couple of years, and I remember, like, I was mostly signing up for, like, music classes and, like, art classes and all kinds of things. And I remember my mom kind of being like, what are you doing? Like, if you're going to go to school, you got to take some more academics. This is ridiculous. And my dad just kind of said to me, like, do whatever you want. If you want to take art classes, just take art classes.
Wow.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Did you ever expect that the Beastie Boys would be together for 25 years?
No. We didn't know. I mean, it's not like we had no idea it was going to be for 25 days.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, when we started the band, maybe I'm speaking for myself here. There was no, like, big ambition. It was kind of like, you know, that was a time when we were going to see bands all the time. A lot of our friends were in bands, so it just seemed like the natural thing. Like, okay, let's start a band and have fun. You know,
play a couple of gigs or whatever.
Yeah, we were in high school. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to take over the world and do this for our whole lifetimes. I mean, I do think, I'd say about last 3 to 5 years, my mom has finally realized that I'm not going to get a day job.
Yeah. You know, I think if we knew that the band was going to be around for this long, we probably would have thought of a better name.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
How did you think of the name?
I had nothing to do with this. It's Adam Horvitz.
It just seemed like it was a funny idea at the time. It was literally like we thought we were probably just going to play a handful of gigs. You know, all our friends were in bands. Everybody was in bands. You just like used to throw together a band and like write a couple songs, play a couple shows, and you're done. You know.
I mean, also part of the fun of being in a band was coming up with the stupidest name you could think of.
Like my band New Wave Old Hat. That's a big one.
Angry Samoans is a good name.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having us.
Okay. Thank you.
The Beastie Boys recorded in 2006. Their new album, Hot Sauce Committee Part 2, was released earlier this week. The extended video for the first single, Make Some Noise, was directed by Adam Yauch. Also known as Fight for Your Right Revisited, the video features Will Ferrell, Jack Black, John C. Reilly, Seth Rogen, and others playing the Beastie Boys young and old. You can find a link to the video on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.